welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my very special guest, Alyssa Hammond, former member of IHOP. Alyssa, it's so good to have you on today and to tell your story. We've been chatting for quite a while now before we started recording, and as I'm getting everything set up, we're talking Star Trek and all of the fun stuff, so now we're going to switch over to the IHOP stuff, but maybe if you could just pause a minute and tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
So I was at 13 years old, my parents moved to Kansas City. My dad often says one of the things that resonated with him was when Mike said, you know, if you feel like a square peg in a round hole, this is the place for you. And it wasn't just that, it was many other things. You know, he really connected with the prophetic history. He felt he had some dreams and just other things that like lined up with it even before he'd ever heard of Kansas City, just kind of like weird stuff, that led him to believe that God was calling us. And so he moved us. I wasn't happy about it at the time because, you know, I was 13 and I was being uprooted. But I plugged into my new life pretty quickly though. I was the youngest member of the prophecy teams and the dance team. So I got recruited right away. That wasn't normal though for 13-year-olds. But I happened to be doing that. So, my life was like, I go to school during the week, and then on the weekend, I work, you know, we go to Friday night service where we learn about Song of Solomon, and then Saturday we get up, we go work the prophecy rooms for about 4 hours, me and my dad, and then we go to some random, you know, fast food place in Grandview, and then we run over to the EGS service where Mike talks about the end times and how we're all going to die a horrible death and all that, and then we wake up the next morning and I dance, you know, at Sunday morning, you know, church service. And then we go home, and then we have a small group or more IHOPers come over to our house and we talk about the end times and whatnot. And so then, you know, by the end of the weekend, I'm totally exhausted and I got to wake up and go to school and start it all over. And there was my doorbell.
You know, it's funny because in what you just said and what we've previously talked about, you're describing my former life, although I was not a dancer and you don't want to see me dance, I can be honest with you. But we lived in that mentality. The world was ending. We were joyfully doomed. I don't know how best to describe this. We were joyfully doomed and we enjoyed the fact that the world was ending. And it's really sad when you think about it because of what that does to a child. And I just, you know, looking back, there were so many things I felt. Today, I feel kind of robbed because I lost opportunities in living in this mindset. What was it like for you as a child in this? What were you thinking when you were dancing about the end of the world? What went through your head?
It's funny you say that because we actually, like, would do these dance productions about, like, eschatological scripture passages, like, at every One Thing conference every year. I grew up, and again, I was 13, so I was very young, and maybe things just sank in deeper for me, but I feel like most of the people around me were not terrified like I was. They were like, oh, this is so cool and so epic and so glorious, and I was like, are you kidding me? This is like the worst thing ever. Like, I'm praying to God that this doesn't actually happen in my lifetime, even though I am 100% convinced that it is because of all the yada yada yada, right? Like all this extra biblical prophetic confirmation. Therefore, I know for sure that I'm going to die some horrific death, probably like in a concentration camp somewhere. So, you know, in school, when I'm required to read Corrie ten Boom, that takes on a whole new meaning for me because I'm like looking at my future, you know? It was very dark. I often thought like I really wish I could die. Like it would actually just be better to not live through this. Like I just want to skip this part, God, and go to heaven. And like, I guess you would call that suicidal. You know, at the time it was kind of like, not that I ever like attempted to take my own life, but I didn't have any hope for the future or like joy for living. And I was a teenager, you know?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. And it's weird because in the Branham cult, there was different splinter groups and you go to one part of the country and it was the same thing. It had the same foundation of doomsday, but they had different takes on how it would all happen out. And I can clearly remember as a child going to one part of the country, and they were preaching on the concentration camps. The Russians were going to storm the shores, they're going to rape the women, and they're going to steal the children. And one horrific scene that still, I'll never get it out of my head, but I think it came from my own mother telling me that they will actually tie people between two elephants and rip their bodies apart whenever all of this comes down. And so you'd go to one part of the country and it's like, I don't know, scenes off of a B-rated horror movie. Then you go to another part and they had quote-unquote grace, and they said things like, but the bride won't have to go through this, and the special elite of the believers, if you can just be that one in a million. And they would, they would do this kind of stuff. So they had like tiers of doomsday. You had the rank and file members who weren't the good, who weren't the elite of the members, and they're going to be ripped together, ripped apart by these elephants and whatnot. And you know,
the peasant.
Yeah, the peasant. You're the peasants of our cult, right? And you know, and now you say that, that actually triggered me. And I'm thinking there were actually doctrines where there were entire sermons about the peasants of the cult. They were, I think they used maybe the foolish virgins. They used some kind of biblical passage, and they said these are the lesser ones, and they're the ones that'll suffer. Well, we are not going to suffer, but to a kid, man, this is not what you want to hear. This is not a healthy thing to hear.
No, it is not. Yeah, and I didn't, again, it's like it's years later that I'm finally putting that together. Like as an adult, I started to like have, so Mike Bickle would get like random emails that are about like how things are going so horribly in the world. And then he'd like forward them to my mom, who would then like forward them to me. And then they'd hit my inbox, and then I'd have like an anxiety, like panic attack sort of thing, like every time, like, even though it's like, okay. And because like my husband, so he is not an IHOPper, like, thank God. he was like, that's crazy. He was like, that's just like conspiracy theorists. Like, he's like, don't. And I'm like, but it feels so real. And I think when it comes from your parents, like I didn't really individuate like really ever, probably recently, maybe, you know, it was like in my 30s.
Yeah.
So my parents' voice was always like the word of God to me. So if they're endorsing something, and Mike Bickle too, right? Like if they're endorsing something or saying something, it just resonates with me. And like, even if I don't want to believe it, it's like deep down, I had this like gut feeling that they're right, you know, and I'm wrong, even though my brain's kicking in and it doesn't, it's like, I was taught to ignore my own intuition, my own instincts, my own, what I'm hearing from the Lord. If what like Mike is saying or what my parents are saying contradicts it. I would say those are probably the strongest voices. There were other teachers and other voices too, but I'd say those three are probably equally powerful in my life, which is wild to say, but
yeah.
Mainly Mike. Obviously the parent thing makes sense, but the fact that someone that wasn't my parent could have that strong of a power, you know.
It's fun. What your husband said, I had an interview with a man and a woman. The woman had escaped the Branham cult from here in the main sect, and the man, they fell in love, and he married her, and they're telling their story, and he just doesn't understand any of this. And he said, I was with her one day, and she wanted me to listen to a tape of this guy that sounded like Adolf Hitler, and he said something to the effect that women aren't worth a good bullet to shoot them, or I can't remember how he said it, but he's quoting directly from, you know, from Branham. And the look on his face when he said it, it was hard for me not to laugh, because I'm trying to picture myself in his shoes. When you hear something like this, it's just nuts. And you look back to the doctrine, and what you said is exactly dead on. There's so much of it that was nothing more than conspiracy theories, but they weren't even the cool ones. Like, I've studied conspiracy theories, and some of them are kind of fascinating, but these aren't. These are like, I don't know how to explain. Yeah, it's like the worst possible way to punish people in their minds is all this was.
Yeah, we didn't, you said there were tiers in your group where like you could escape the tribulation. We didn't have that luxury at all. Like, we were taught, you know, like, okay, the rapture, that's wrong, that's not happening, and like given all the reasons why. And so there was no hope, there was no escape. like there was no mental, you know, because a lot of the kids that I know that were in more traditional environments, they would teach the rapture, and that was kind of their out. Like, okay, yeah, like we're going to take Revelation literally here, but we don't have to be here, you know. But then, like, I was taught by many teachers, like, all the reasons why that's not, you know, actually biblically accurate, nor was it the historical view. You know, it's a recent view, and like all the things. So I was, of course, like very convinced, and therefore, you know, and I'm still convinced, frankly. You know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I'm at the point where I'm just like willing to lay all my theology on the table. But that rapture thing, that definitely has a lot of holes in it. So
yeah, there's so much. I went through several iterations after leaving. In fact, it's kind of good. I had an original YouTube site that the cult attacked and brought down. So I had all kinds of videos. Some of them had 100,000 views or more. And the cult attacked it and brought it down. They're trying to suppress the information. So I'm rebuilding, starting a new one. But I look back at the way that my mind was back during those years that I had it. And I was a crazy nut. I'll just say it, man. I had just escaped this thing, and there was so much packed into my head that I was trying to evaluate. And the problem is, it's like a ball of yarn that's, you pull the string and then it just kind of unravels. Well, that was happening to me verbally as I was pulling strings out of my head of things that I believed. And the more I pulled, the more nuts it got. You know what I mean? It's like there are nuts stepped on top of nuts, further nonsense. And when you pull it all out and you realize that none of the conspiracy theories were even close to something that a normal person would even believe, then you're stuck in this world of, well, what do I do? Now I'm no longer in this. And if I tell somebody who is never in it what's in my head, they're going to flip out.
Right, yeah. Yes. Yeah, and so my husband is, you know, I think when I got married, I was actually at the time, I was like, I didn't, because I felt that like he was the guy that the Lord had for me, you know, because at that time it was very much like, you don't have a choice, God picks your person, right? You know, I don't believe that anymore. But, you know, for whatever, and he still was a good choice. I'm not saying he wasn't, but I just, you know, my views were different then. And so at the time it was like, God, I don't understand why you would pick somebody for me that didn't grow up in the same community as me, because there's just parts of me he's never going to understand, you know? And obviously I see now why the Lord did that, because he needed someone to bounce me out and help point out, you know, the flaws and the weaknesses. But it is true that like there are parts of me that he's never going to get, you know, like only other cult members like understand, you know, like the specific, you know, like nature of everything, right? So yeah, that is definitely, I think there's an inherent loneliness when you come out of something like this, because you're leaving behind everyone who gets you, and then you're jumping into a world of people who just inherently don't get you, like, you know, because it sounds wacko if you say it out loud.
It is. And you know, and I'm still like, I still keep going back to the conspiracy theory, because I can't believe that I believe some of this stuff. I really can't. But what's odd is for me, and I don't know if it may be the same for you, after you leave, you no longer believe any of the conspiracy theory nonsense. But when you have people that some major event happens in the world that is tied to one of those conspiracy theories, they want to do the, aha, see, we're right, and they send you the conspiracy theory. Now, Me, I've already moved on. I realize that it's nonsense, and so it looks further like nonsense when they send it to me. But then to them, they think they're sending me some great revelation that proves that all of this nonsense was correct. Has that happened to you since you've left?
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, like, especially, I don't like throwing people under the bus. It's hard because, like, there's many people that are like relatives and very close to me, and we're all at different stages in this process, right? Like since, you know, since October, like a lot of people are starting to like kind of wake up to things. I was a little farther along in my journey by then, but I still didn't understand the ramifications of like the fullness of it. It was more just like, I sense something is off, but didn't really understand that it was like, oh, something is deeply off here, you know.
And it's really odd, too, whenever you feel something that feels off, because all of that mental programming comes back in your head, right?
Yeah, I have to fight a lot of things, yeah. Like, well, so to give an example, so like around maybe, I don't know, 2020, so around there, I started to realize that like something was off about the eschatology, mainly because the fruit of it in my own life was panic attacks, right? fear, anxiety, you know, no joy, no peace, no hope, right? Like all these things, you know, and I feel like the Lord was leading me to Matthew 24, where it's like, you know, at IHOP, you're taught that the main point of this passage is that we're supposed to know the times and the seasons, right? So which means, and by that, they mean watch the news and freak out about current events. Like, I feel like is what they were, that's the application. And I was like, okay, Jesus is like, okay, but what is this really about? And he's like, what is the thing I'm mainly saying here? It's watch and pray, right? Like watch and pray. And it doesn't mean watch the news. It means watch him. And so it started me make, like, it led me on a journey of realizing like that something was off. There was this preoccupation, this like hyper focus on all these things that was just making everybody, or at least me, terrified. I think a lot of people didn't take it that seriously or didn't understand, maybe. Because like when I would say this to my parents later on, they would be like, well, we never taught you this. We never said that. We never taught you about the, you know, that you were going to die some horrific death. And I'm like, I mean, maybe you didn't actually say it, but you put me in a community where this is the ramification of like what they're saying. Right. Like when they're teaching this thing, like, this is how I'm applying it to my life. Like, and I did have people tell me, yes, we'll be in concentration camps. So like, not them, but like maybe others or whatever.
So I got to have your take on this. I'm on the outside looking in, and I'm still trying to untangle, or as Brantley calls it, detangle all of this mess that is IHOP. And I understand Paul Kane. I understand his connection to Branham, and I can see how Branhamism evolved into this. The trails are just very obvious. But the thing that is the total, it's like a black box to me, is trying to understand Bob Jones. How did you see him as a child when you saw some of the things that he said and did? What was it like seeing all of this stuff about Bob Jones?
Yeah, so that's a good question, actually. Bob wasn't really around by the time I was there. So I guess, like, so I was there, like, pretty much at the beginning of the prayer room, like, IHOP. You know, like, we were in trailers. We were getting the thing going. My family is one of the first families to come for that. But I think Bob and Paul Kane, the Kansas City Prophets, was kind of leading up to that. And then by the time the prayer room was around, they weren't really around. Or if they were, they may have visited once or twice, you know, kind of thing. But they weren't, like, super integrally involved. However, we heard their names all the time because we had to study the prophetic history. Well, I say had to. Well, you know, for students, some students were required to. And so maybe when I was, at the time that I was a student, it was required. But as a child, I just listened to it because, like, it was, you know, cool and, right, like, to me and fascinating, right? So we studied it, and my dad was obsessed with it and, you know, everything. So Bob Jones was more of a mythological character, and so was Paul Kane. And I do have vague memories of at some point in my teenage years them talking about, like, how Paul Kane and Bob Jones at different times had stumbled morally, but it was very glossed over and minimized. Also had randomly heard about Ernie Gruen and how, like, he is, you know, it's in the prophetic history actually that he had, like, attacked Mike and that ultimately repented and, like, you know, Meg forgave him and all these things about, like, how humble Mike was during that whole thing. And then the guy died and, like, all this stuff, right? So there was this, like, story that was spun, and that's just what I believed. And so it wasn't until, like, October that I actually started, like, you know, looking into things and, like, you know, I found your podcast, right? Like, there's, you know, like, other resources that were like, oh, hey, maybe the story that was spun and told to you wasn't the real story. So I guess for me, yeah, Bob Jones was just like this awesome dude that, like, had this uncanny ability to hear from the Lord, same as Paul Kane. You know, it was kind of quirky or whatever, but, like, yeah, you know, and guys like that, and Mike, because Mike told these stories about how he'd go to heaven and stuff, you know, like in a chariot and whatever, and, like, see God directly. And so I wanted to be close to these people because I wanted to be close to God. And I'm like, well, if they're that close to God, then if I get closer, you know. So yeah, I guess that's who they were in my mind, were kind of like myth. There was the mythology there. They weren't real people. So yeah, yeah, I wasn't old enough to have been around when they were actually super involved.
That makes sense. And the fact that it's glossed over makes great sense. One of the other, and I'll open up to you and the world about this. One of the issues that I'm struggling with right now is that the information is so critical, but it's also so bad that I can't actually say it on YouTube, or YouTube will censor me. If I say the things, if I say the things that Bob Jones did, I get censored, yep, and the video gets knocked down. And that's, you know, I'm looking through Ernie Gruen's report. I'm looking at some other things, and Mike Bickle ties the origins of this movement all the way back to the years in which Bob Jones was there. So this was significant, but yet it's so bad I can't even put it on YouTube.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, you have to use terms like CSA and like all the things, right? To that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to find a non-offensive way to talk about a man who is asking women into his private quarters to do things that I right. can't say, or YouTube will censor me. It's just, it's so nuts. And, you know, I take a step back because all of this very eerily, similarly resembles what I came from, although in the Branham cult it was men with men instead of men with women. But I look at this and it's the same thing, it's just different. But neither one of them can be possibly a move by God, because this isn't the way that God operates. God doesn't send predators to his people and say, here, listen to my predator, my beloved predator who I'm sending you.
International House of Predators, you know.
I actually had not heard that one yet, so.
I think that's actually, I just came up with that in my own mind. One
awesome.
Time.
I'm using it. Going forward, I'm using it.
Another one I think me and my brother were joking about was pickling. It referred to the pickle.
You know? Oh, yeah. So whenever I'm
pickling people, that's funny.
So whenever I made the little cartoon and I chose pickle, that actually had more meaning than I even knew, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, most people say pickle debacle. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I think pickle might be a better word. But anyways, I don't want to be like throwing people under the bus. It's hard because I feel like I'm walking the line of like, there are so many people that are like at the point where they can like, you know, lightheartedly joke about things, right? And then there's people that are like definitely not there. And I don't like want to hurt people's feelings or offend people or seem callous. But sometimes it's just, you've been through so much, you just like start joking about it, you know, even though it is serious.
Well, and it's a healthy way. I used to read the Reader's Digest magazines and laughter's the best medicine, you know. It's a healthy way for your mind to comprehend something that has happened to you that's very bad, but not drive you deep into depression. So there are things that I try to find the funny in everything in my history. And I'll open up about this too. I think I did this before, but usually when it's something that's really bad involving a character that I would have normally just feared in the cult, I try to put, instead of his face in my mind, I put Daffy Duck or Bugs Bunny. And I think of it, I frame it like that. So in my mind, it's different. But then the problem is, as I'm talking to people through the podcast, I've got Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck in my brain. So right. I have to be careful how it comes out. But to people who are escaping or in the process of deciding whether or not to escape, what I learned is there are varying levels of being able to laugh about it. Some of the people who are hurting the most and they're getting ready to leave, when they see other people laughing about it, they think it's mockery. They really don't understand. But then people who are trying to reconcile what just happened to them after they escape, they kind of see the humor in it, but they're hurting so badly they can't laugh. And it's not until you go through those two stages that, yeah, this was some kind of funny stuff I was in. What in the world was I thinking, you know?
Right.
So we initially, for the Branham cults, we set up different, I guess you'd call them silos of support groups. So if you first come out, this is the shell-shocked group, and then here's the angry at the world group, and then here's the yay, let's party group. And
yeah, it's like the stages of grief. I feel like I've seen that even in myself.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
disbelief. And then there's anger and bargaining. I've been in that, you know, like, if only I had not gone to IHOP, you, right? If only I had not, yeah. And I do want to disclaim and say, like, it's not like it was all bad. Like, I, you know, grew up with a very strong personal relationship with the Lord. And a lot of that is due to some of the good, you know, and actually scripturally based teachings that I was exposed to, and being in an environment that prayer was encouraged, right? So, you know, there were things that were mine, that were me and the Lord, that weren't being outside influenced by like weird stuff that, you know, I still have and I still take with me. So it was not all bad. And, you know, like a lot of people went and had like, you know, similar, like a lot of good experience. I think it's just when people start getting into the prophetic history and applying, you know, eschatology to current events, you know, and all that stuff, that it starts to, and when anytime it's just getting off of scripture and into this like weird little side cult area. That's where it, you know, starts to hurt people.
I get it. And a lot of people think that because of the way that I do what I do, it's mostly the critical stuff. They think I didn't have a, I didn't view my life as a happy life, as a happy little cult member waiting for the world to end. There were good times. And I mean, we had some real, real fun. The one of the things about a cult is you have this level of closeness that you're not going to find anywhere else in the world. After you leave, you'll never find it again because it's actually an unhealthy level of closeness. And so when you leave, you miss that. But while you're in it and you don't realize how destructive it is to be that much in other people's business, it feels good and you feel like you're, I don't know, it's almost like being married to every single person in the cult. You're right in each other's business. And it's not that way until you, you know, for normal people, until they get married, they don't find anybody that they connect that closely with. So we had happy times, we had good times, but at the same time, it was unhealthy and destructive, and our minds were, you know, our minds were being abused. It was spiritual abuse. In many cases, it was emotional abuse. And some people suffer whenever they leave the cult with the, I'm drawing a blank on the syndrome, but whenever an abuse victim wants to go back to the abuser, a lot of people who escape a cult, they go through that. And somebody in the comment feed can say what that
exact thing is. Oh, yeah, it's eluding me as well, but I totally, a Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm syndrome, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, was it, I don't know if you've ever seen The Office. I assume you probably have, but there's that quote from, what's his face? Where he's like, oh, I've been in many cults, both as leader and follower. You know, you have more fun.
I laughed
as a
so hard when I heard that.
You make more money as a leader, but you have more fun as a follower.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So you went through life, you started as a young dancer, you were looking for the world to end. Once you got into your adult years, how did it affect your way of thinking? What the frame of reference that they indoctrinated you with as a kid, how did that impact your normal day-to-day life as an adult?
Yeah, well, I mean, I chose to go to ministry school. It wasn't even IHOPU at the time. It was FSM and then FMA, and I had a YWAM year in between. All the acronyms. So I gave up, you know, a normal college experience, which at the time seemed like, you know, like better and holy. And I, you know, there were good things about it. You know, like I had a lot of classes from like good teachers like Alan Hood, who actually taught, you know, like really great stuff, you know, like and actually heard sermons about the cross. Like what, you know, that was a rarity, believe it or not. But, so yeah, like there were definitely like good things about it, but you know, I didn't pursue like a normal path. I ultimately ended up being able to turn my years in ministry like and kind of merge them into an education degree. I still took education classes, but I was able to kind of like get to where I needed to go because there were still some schools that would take IHOP credits at the time. I'm sure they won't anymore. But yeah, so I was able to get a Christian education degree, and I taught in a private school that was right across the street from IHOP. So the course, and I was extremely involved in theater. I directed theater for like 10 years. So, you know, it's not like things went bad. Like I enjoyed what I did. Education though was very exhausting. And, I guess I maybe just one of the practical physical things, right, is I'd already burned myself out, like from the age of 13 up, like, you know, and then at IHOPU, like it was even more intense of a schedule. Cause I was also still doing like prophecy rooms and dance team on top of the, you know, 24 hours in the prayer room and all these classes and all these services and all these things. It was a lot. So it was, and then my body started to like fall apart. So I guess some of the other ramifications was like my physical health was really impacted. And I think that's ultimately what kind of pushed me out. I didn't stay, because yeah, my body, I just feel like couldn't really even handle it. And then even as a teacher, you know, so I came into that already worn out, and then I'm teaching, you know, and that's exhausting. And so I just got to the point where, you know, I got married, and then after a couple of years, I had to leave teaching and go do like administrative jobs for like different ministries and stuff, because my body just was like burned out, and I just had so many like digestive issues. Like my hands would just like shake, and people would think I was on drugs, and I'm like, I'm not on drugs. Like I'm just nauseous, and my stomach like just can't handle any kind of food. Like it was bad. So yeah, I would say my physical health was very impacted by just kind of the, like, I don't know what you even call that. It's just like this pressure to, like, you never rest. There's no like observing the Sabbath. You know, that's something I've had to learn, like, in my adult life. And it's hard to do as a mom, but I try to, like, have at least, like, one day a week, you know, where, like, the kids are with the grandparents and I'm, like, actually resting, like, you know, cause you know, the Sabbath, I guess, right? Like, Sundays, it's like, oh, well, those are work days, like, or they used to be, right? And so I'm like, I'm working, my whole weekend was working, you know, in ministry. And so I guess seeing ministry as this work thing that just, like, drains you. So I'm trying to reorient myself now to see, you know, just a practical level that, like, spirituality is not separate from, like, physical and emotional well-being. You know, like, this is all one thing. So resting is a spiritual thing to do. You know, I don't have to feel guilty that I'm resting instead of, you know, running around serving and doing whatever, you know, that I think is spiritually productive or whatever, you know.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I've read a few books by cult experts about the effects on the body from being in a cult, and they talk about they call it high control groups or high demand groups, and they push the people to exhaustion, because while they're in a state of exhaustion, they're very easy to manipulate the minds. Yep. Because their mind is tired. And so one of the key differences between IHOP and what was in the Branham movement that it came from, We weren't as demanding as what I see with IHOP. It's like hyper demand. It's crazy, physically exhausting. But we were mentally exhausted, because we listened to these long recordings and constantly focus on doomsday, much like you did. And one of the things that I've noticed, and countless people, I've worked with several people out of the cults, while they're in the group, they look unhealthy. Some of the women, mm-hmm. especially, because the women are the most abused in the Branham religions, they look sickly and weak. And sometimes we've got, you know, groups all over Facebook and Twitter, etc. Sometimes whenever a person joins the group, just to make sure they're not a cult plant, I go through some of their profile and look at what they're saying in the pictures, etc. And it's weird, because if you go back far enough, you see a person who looks sick and weak and tired and worn out, but then after they escape, it's like they've got new life. It's like a new birth almost. And you know, you can attribute some of that to just being excited about leaving a cult, but I've been in the support groups long enough that I have seen people go through that initial excitement and then enter into, unfortunately, after the excitement, there's a reality that hits you, and it's a burden, because now you feel sorry for all those people in it, and it kind of brings balance to your sudden party, your sudden excitement of being leaving, of having left. And so I look at the pictures from that point in time, and they still look healthier. So I know it's not the excitement. What would you say about your health after leaving? Has it changed?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm much healthier now than I was. And I had to go through, you know, there's just a lot of, like, practical steps I had to take. Like, for one, you know, not being in the environments that were emotionally abusive, frankly. You know, that, because that also was a contributing factor. It wasn't just the demand. It was also, like, the emotional stress, you know. And yeah, I had to, you know, I started juicing every day. That helped. I literally like drink like giant, like just enormous amounts of vegetables in liquid form, basically. So I'm one of those. So, you know, like, yeah, my body did eventually recover. You know, I was able to have two children, you know, when I was like seriously worried at one point that like I just was not able to handle it. So, and motherhood is like extremely exhausting and physically demanding, but like, you know, I've gotten through it, you know, so I mean, I'm still in it, but I got through the pregnancies and all that. Yeah. So yeah. You know, and then we moved to Florida, so I get a lot more sunshine now. So that's nice.
Oh, wow. I would love to live there. My wife won't move there because of the bugs. She says the bugs are just too big. And the alligators. Yes. She cannot take the alligators.
Well, we have a lot of screens. Like, we've got screened-in porches and all that to handle the bugs. And yes, yeah. The alligators are kind of like tornadoes. Like, when you live in Midwest, it's like, ah, yeah, whatever, tornadoes. Here, it's like, ah, whatever, alligators. Like, you know, obviously, I don't let my kids run around outside unsupervised, but, you know, like, yeah. I'm not, like, in my house huddling in fear of alligators.
One of the other things that I've noticed, when a person leaves a cult and they have children, their perspective is so much different than their parents because, well, the parents are in a cult, so, you know, it's obviously going to be different. But where other parents are thinking for the well-being of the child and the normal motherhood, fatherhood stuff, a person who has escaped a cult has baggage beyond that. They're thinking about all of the things that their child can do that they never could, and the life that they can have that they, in many ways, they were hindered from having. How has it affected you as a mother with your children?
Yeah, I would say, so yeah, my husband obviously was not, you know, from my world. He was from a totally different world. So I think like ironing out the what I'm okay with, you know, like has even evolved like since getting married and, you know, having kids. Like initially it was like, we will never celebrate Halloween, you know, like, and now it's like, here we are, you know, they're in their little costumes, trick or treating. And, you know, and there's part of me that's like, oh, the devil's holiday. And part of me that's like, whatever. So, I don't know. I guess there has been this gradual evolving. Cause again, it wasn't even till October that I even like it fully sank in like, oh, wow, like all of these like feelings I've been having about that things were being off, those are like super valid and like way more valid than I knew. So I think for a long time, I still just like have felt guilty and felt like ultimately like I'm wrong and they're really right deep down. And so now I think for the first time, it's like, oh, maybe like they're not actually right deep down, like at all, you know? So it's probably affected my perspective on like, you know, like entertainment, you know, like, and I like my, yeah, you know, there's just so many things about like the world I grew up in. And this isn't even necessarily specific to IHOP. It's also just kind of a charismatic conservative thing. Just like paranoid, like my parents, like they've loosened up over the years. You know, I like to say like, I wasn't allowed to watch Barney. You know, I'm the oldest child because of the magic. Never not to mention the fact that Barney ended up being a pedophile. We don't care about that. We just care about the magic.
Yeah.
But like my little brother Simeon was sitting there watching like Braveheart and Gladiator, like sucking his thumb, you know. So that, but that also wasn't even that far off really, because there was like, violence is fine. They got to get used to this because this is what their future is going to be. But there can be no sex, right? Like, or sorry, I probably can't say that word without you getting flagged.
No, it's okay.
Bleep it out.
Yeah.
there was like, you can watch rated R as long as it's violence, but if it's anything else, you can't watch it. I don't know. So there was all these like weird rules about like movies and entertainment. So kind of like as an adult, like easing myself into like making my own choices and like using my own discernment and like loosening up on a lot of those things, being like, oh, I used to think that like this was God saying that you can or can't do this. And like, no, it actually wasn't, you know, it was people saying that, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, with regards to the S word, which I'll probably leave it, it'll probably be okay, but I'll never forget, when we left the cult, I was working with a guy who had, he had been in the Branham cult back, you know, years before me, but he was from another country, and in that country, it wasn't the same as in America. So whenever he was a, you know, an adolescent, he went to the beach, there were nude beaches, and the skin wasn't the same. The way that people viewed the skin wasn't the same in his country. And he came to America and it's like, what is this? People here are freaks, man. It's not normal. God gave you that skin, you know?
Right.
And it was the first time that I ever came to realize that even that was unhealthy. And mm-hmm. so I'm one of these people that I just study things to no end. So I start going through everything that I could find about the ancient world and the ancient clothing and what the ancient Christians would have wore. And you look at some of the togas that the women would have wore, and, you know, Greek and Roman Christians, and man, my children would not be allowed to be with a woman who is dressed like that, you know? And so, and you talk about the festivals, the Halloween. I think it was that same person. He said, John, I don't understand why you can't move on beyond this false religion. And he came from the same religion. He was further along than me. But he said, look at Colossians 2. Let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, and with regard to a festival or new moon or Sabbath. Do you understand, John, what Halloween is? It's the festival for the new moon, and every country has its own version of this. And he was explaining this to me, and I'm scratching my head thinking, yeah, but there's demons, there's witches, and you know, I was like, you know, this can't be. We forced ourselves early on. I want to say it was within 2 years of leaving the cult. Another ex-cult member invited us to a Halloween party. And it was one of the most fun things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, holidays, because I even remember, like, I love Christmas, like, big deal to me. But as, like, my parents kind of got to this point, I don't know if they started getting influenced by some of the people that were like, you know, Christmas is actually a pagan holiday, like Constantine, blah, 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 so we shouldn't celebrate it. So they started to lose their Christmas enthusiasm. And it got to the point where it's like, I'm by myself putting up a Christmas tree because, like, I'm the only one that will do it, you know. So definitely, obviously, as, you know, having my own household, I'm like, we do Christmas around here. But yeah, there was just a lot of, like, joy that was, like, stolen by, like, these kind of, these, like, legalistic ideas, like, oh, well, all, you know, like, these religions are rooted in paganism, therefore, holidays are rooted in paganism, therefore, we can't celebrate them. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, like, sure, maybe there's pagan roots to this stuff, but it doesn't mean that you can't, it's like being in the world, but not of it, right? It's like, we don't want to just totally separate ourselves from the culture. We can still, like, be salt and light in the culture. We don't have to participate in the things that we feel are not good, but we don't have to just completely reject joy and happiness.
Well, and it's even, for me, it's even deeper than that. Like I say, I study things to no end. I can't tell you how many books I read about this, but it isn't that we're taking that from the pagan cultures. It's that the pagan cultures took that from just simple logistics on how to grow food. You have to study the moon cycles in order to, and the harvest. All of it works together because we live in this world where there is a winter, there is a summer, there is a time to plant, there's a time to sow, there's a time to reap, so on and so forth. And so eventually over time, that's how they celebrated this. And the celebrations turned into the pagan deities, etc. But from its inception, it was just literally celebrating the harvest, the moons, the things that people required in order to live. You had to know those things to live. We have watches and calendars, and it's all foreign to us. We wouldn't think about having to go outside and look at the moon to know should we plant our corn right now or not. But what happened was the pagan cultures built their all of their holidays and their rituals around this, and then the moons became worshipped as deities, etc. It entered into pantheons of deities. And then fast forward into, you know, Halloween, well, we're doing the same thing that originally was just a celebration of a harvest. But because of all of this weird history that went with it, you have the witches and the demons and the Draculas and whatnot. And I like fiction, so I enjoy it. And I don't think people could take it away from me now.
Well, that shows how far you've come, huh?
Exactly. So let's talk about life after cult. And that's something that everyone who listens to the our stories on the podcast, really that's what they're looking for. They're looking for how do we survive after leaving this thing. And a lot of people, everybody goes their own separate ways. Some people remain Christian, some people don't. What was it like for you whenever you came to try to decide religiously where you were going after the cult? I'm assuming you remain Christian. What did you choose and where did you go?
Yeah, I think that's like an ever-evolving thing. You know, I've always had that personal relationship with the Lord. through everything. And so I've never lost that. But at the same time, you know, like the reason why we're even doing this is because I reached out to you for recommendations on apologetics books. So obviously there, it's like, I feel like there's this like split thing going on in my brain. There's the me that knows deep down that I love Jesus and that he's real. And then there's the me that's like, but wait a minute, there's a lot of things that I used to 100% believe were true that are like lies. And so now I have to evaluate everything. So I got to double check. I don't know. I guess there is more of an open-mindedness to be wrong, which is good, because obviously there was much spiritual pride before of like, we have it all figured out. And, you know, all of these little peasants don't know what they're doing. And we are the enlightened ones, right? So let that go. I guess I'm more open to just kind of like, as far as just like all theological things, right? Like what, you know, what should fall to the ground and what should stay, you know, just kind of still there. And, you know, and a lot of it, it's like, you know, there's not a lot that's changed. And then there are a lot that, like, as far as like scriptural things, I feel like, you know, a lot of those things for me haven't changed because they were scripturally rooted, but anything that was just like not scripturally rooted, I'm just like, whatever, you know, that's out.
away with the extra. I'm tired of it.
Yes. So at that point it's like, oh, nope. Gotta be gone. But I mean, that's not a bad thing. But you know, there is that, like, there is those fears that arise of, you know, God, are you real? You know, is Jesus who he said he was? I just got to double check here, you know, and then I've wrestled a lot too emotionally with like, how do I know that I'm saved? Cause I feel like IHOP was a very like works based environment. Not that they ever would have outright said that, but the just what you kind of picked up by being there was like, I got to earn my salvation is kind of it's like the vibe. It's kind of like, I got to try really hard to like be so holy and spiritual. So the idea that there is nothing that I can do to help God save me is just like, still blowing my mind. Like there was a time that I was literally weeping on the floor in my room for like hours, like literally just reading the Gospels, and it was like hitting me for like the first time, like after we had moved to Florida, and I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like I've never heard the Gospel.
Wow. I remember that exact feeling.
Yeah. And then like, oh, The Chosen. I love The Chosen, right? And I'm like, why do I love The Chosen so much? I'm like the biggest fan like ever. And I'm like, maybe it's because I really haven't had the Gospel actually like portrayed to me all that often. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about Revelation and Song of Solomon, but we really didn't, there wasn't a lot of like just basic Christology. I feel like in some ways I'm like a child just like trying to like learn that. But I feel like I'm constantly battling in my mind this idea that like, I got to do something. Like I wasn't baptized exactly the right way. So I got to figure that out. I got to, you know, like if I have even the smallest level of sin somewhere that I can't kick, like that's not acceptable. I'm going to hell. Like I'm fighting all these things a lot. So I feel like that's still a wrestle, even though it's like, I'll rationalize with myself, like all the reasons why that's wrong. I still am not, my heart's not settled. So there's that. And then there's the part of me that's like, I still pray and I still read my Bible and, you know what I mean? I live my life. Like I pray a prayer and God answers it like regularly, you know? So it's like, he's there and I know that he hears me and he answers me. And like, I know. And then there's the part of me that's like, am I even saved? Are you even real? So yeah. So anyways, and so church kind of triggers me a little bit most of the time. So, right now, you know, like, I guess the church that we're at, I don't know. I mean, so you call it, it's non-denominational, but like, what does that mean? Because, right, like IHOP was non-denominational too. So I guess in some ways it's not like I've really switched, but IHOP was not like a traditional non-denominational anything. It was there was a very unique messaging there that you're not going to hear literally anywhere else. So it's not anything like IHOP. But yeah, I guess I've just like, I don't know, mainly like I kind of going like where my husband feels the most connected. And I feel, you know, I don't know. I grew up in a different kind of ministry culture, so I've always wrestled with, like, I don't really feel, there's nothing familiar about this to me, like, all the different places, right? Like, I don't feel connected to people. No one's going to get me. No one's going to understand. Like, and then what is church even? Like, I used to feel really guilty because, like, once I had babies, it was just impractical to go to church in person. So I would web stream, you know, because like, you know, otherwise I'm like, well, I'll just be in the nursing mother's room anyway, streaming. So I might as well be in my living room doing that. You know, like what's the point of being there in person? But I'd always feel guilty about it. And I think I just recently realized like, I don't have to feel guilty about that because I don't think that going to a mega church, sitting there around thousands of people and then leaving is actually what the Bible meant. anyway by church. So, you know, and it's a thing that's good for people. Like, you know, it's helpful to my husband. You know, so it's, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm not saying it's like this biblically mandated thing that that's what it's supposed to look like. And so I feel like that's kind of a freedom for me of like, oh, I don't have to feel guilty that I'm not like a front rower every week, like in person. Like, yeah, we actually, you know, we stream every week, you know? But yeah, I don't know. So I guess I'm not like fully landed anywhere in particular either, because it's hard. It's always been hard for me to connect with most preachers. And at IHOP, it was a little different. Like, I used to think that that was the only place ever that I'd ever connect with anybody. But it actually even got to a point where I wasn't connecting with anything they were saying either. Like, and then my later years, I was, like, sitting there, like, wow, I'm not getting anything out of this. Like, I don't even know what he's saying. He's rambling. like, what is he even saying? He's saying the same things I've heard for 20 years.
Yeah. Oh,
there come the children.
I remember that feeling. I sat down with the minister one day, and I was trying to explain that, you know, we had a different frame of reference than most people had. If you grow up in a cult, you know all the cult things, but a lot of the basics of Christianity, they distract you. They don't want you to know the basics. They want you to know the extra biblical stuff. But then on the flip side, the people who are in normal churches, they have this normal church tradition that they assume everybody knows. So the trouble that I had when I started going into new churches was they were talking about things that they assumed everybody knew and believed, and, well, these weren't our core values. They were their core values. So fortunately, one of the churches had a new Christian convert class, and even though I wasn't a new Christian, I sat through the class, and they took me through the basics of what is the gospel, and suddenly I realized I had no clue what the gospel was. I had this word that I called the gospel that meant nothing like the gospel actually was. But so whenever you left this thing and you started entering new churches, what was it like just learning the gospel for the first time?
I think that, like you said, like growing up at IHOP, I didn't hear a lot of the basics, and I assumed it was just because it's like, oh, well, we're above and beyond that. You know, it's like everyone already knows that, and we're too elite for that, right? Like, we need to be focused on all this stuff because the end is nigh, you know? And then now, like, after everything came out, I'm like, maybe that stuff was just too convicting, and that's why they didn't talk about it. In some cases, now, obviously not everybody was corrupt, but for those that were, like, is that why you didn't talk about, you know, like, basic morality?
Yeah.
So I guess the gospel was more hitting me at a heart level. Afterwards. You know, because it's not like I hadn't heard it. I guess it's just like we were preoccupied with other pursuits, you know, mainly eschatology.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I'm still trying to, I feel like the gospel still hits me. It's really hard. Like, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around that. You know, like, I guess, not my mind. I think it's more just like those, you know, like when you have those deep down, like, gut feelings of like, I may be telling myself the truth, but deep down I don't believe it. You know, I feel like I still have that wrestle.
Yeah. It's hard, and I went through similar things that you're describing for years afterwards, and I remember one period of time in which somebody would ask me what I believed. You know, they're curious because I was in a cult, and my answer that week may not have matched the answer the week before or the week after. It was changing so rapidly because as you're deconstructing and you're pulling out parts of your foundation, when you take a certain piece out, the entire foundation changes. And so a lot of times it completely changes your core makeup and your core values. So if you could give any advice to people who are either thinking about leaving IHOP or people who have left and they're coping with trying to enter the real world and understand what is normal after leaving IHOP, what advice would you give them?
You know, in some ways, normal life is normal life, because IHOP was a part of our lives, but it didn't necessarily, there's just different degrees at which we were all connected and involved. Like, some people had jobs outside already and some people didn't. And those that were financially more dependent on, you know, raising support through there, those are the ones I feel for the most because they're having to completely regroup and, you know, deconstruct whatever level, you know, all at the same time. I guess like the most encouraging thing I could say is that you're not alone. You know, we all may be scattered across the country now. I feel like IHOP was a pretty transient place and most people aren't still there. There are some that are still in Kansas City, but there was just so many people that came through and went and left over the years. But there's a lot of people that, you know, all feel the same way. And even though we all feel like we're, or at least many of us, I know I myself feel like I'm just like processing alone on an island, you know, because everyone in my current life has no idea about my former life, you know. We're not actually alone. There's a lot of other people that are experiencing, you know, the same feelings, and they're not crazy and they're not weird. And that God is still there. You know, Jesus is still there through all of it. And, you know, he's fully able to lead us through the process, and he's not afraid of the process.
Well, that's good advice. Thank you so much for getting on here. I'm sure you're going to give a lot of people great encouragement, and thank you for doing this.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the NAR, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.